It's a great pleasure to welcome to this forum Aaron Brown. Aaron is a professor and author. He's currently a professor with NYU's Courant Institute for the Mathematical Sciences. He's author of several books. The book we will talk about today is Red-Blooded Risk, The Secret History of Wall Street. Aaron has been on Wall Street for about 35 years as a trader, portfolio manager, head of mortgage securities, and risk manager for some of the largest global financial institutions. The last 10 years as risk manager at AQR Capital. Aaron does have a BS degree in applied math from Harvard and an MBA in finance and statistics from the University of Chicago. And Aaron, I read quite the fascinating background that you have also in poker. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that, because our audience is quite familiar with the William Poundstone book, Fortune's Formula, and some of the history at Thorpe and the others and how poker has actually influenced investors as well. So if you don't mind, give us just a little bit of background, and then we'll talk about the book itself.
Thanks, John. Happy to be here. Welcome to everyone listening at the conference or elsewhere. To start with poker, Ed's a good friend of mine, and actually I talked to William Poundstone when he was writing his book. I think the key is not just poker specifically, but, you know, blackjack gambling, sports betting, all sorts of casino gambling. The reason it's important in the history of finance and Wall Street is I was part of a generation that in the 1970s, that we were unhappy with the way quantitative methods were taught in economics and finance and in universities. And we just, you know, the way I would put it is, we didn't think our professors would bet a nickel of their own money on the kind of analyses they were writing and publishing. And what we ended up doing is we ended up going to Las Vegas. Of course, Ed had been there in the early 60s, but actually it was some of the same reasons. If you can prove your ideas in a casino, in a poker game, in a sports betting, you know it's not because, you know, you cleverly phrased them or because you were popular at the faculty Christmas party or whatever. It's because, you know, people are really trying not to give you their money. If your ideas work there, then they really work. We learned an awful lot of stuff about mathematics, about risk-taking, about money, that we then turned around and, you know, back starting in the late 70s, early 80s, we started taking it to Wall Street. So there's a real connection there. If you, you know, if you start learning about risk and money in finance, you run the risk of picking up an awful lot of traditional wisdom that isn't true, a lot of academic theories that don't really work. If you prove yourself at the poker table or the casino, then you know you got some things that really work. Of course, whether you can turn them into, you know, financial ideas, that's a separate question, but at least you're starting from truth.
That's a great point. Essentially, testing your ideas in the market as opposed to testing them with peers or articles or what have you. And one sentence that really struck me on your website, erader.com, where you talk about some of your early experiences, is you said, "What thrilled me was to learn I could walk into a room of strangers and walk out with their money, and no one got mad." That sounds like an ideal scenario, and it, I guess it's similar in the financial markets as well. That if you can develop the kinds of quantitative methods that actually work, you are going to outperform.
Yeah, and I think that's very important. You know, if you approach poker as, you know, well, here's a mathematical problem, or, you know, here's a card game, you're missing the point. You got to start with it. But my goal is to walk in here, take their money, and walk out and leave them happy. You know, I want to get invited back next week. I don't want to get shot in the back. I don't want them to, you know, report me to the police and get me arrested or something like that. Similarly in finance, you know, your goal is to go in there and come out with more money than you started with, but not by, you know, making everybody else angry, not by, you know, kind of burning your bridges as you're doing it, but by building a sustainable strategy and practice. And people who come with that broader attitude, you know, learn. They pay attention to a lot of things that you might not notice if you're just focused on, you know, today's P&L, did I make or lose money on that last trade? You know, you always want to be asking yourself, who's losing the money I'm making? You know, and are they my customer? Am I doing something for them that they like and they're willing to pay for? In which case, I want them to know me. I want them to know me and like me, and I want to advertise. Or am I taking money from people who are unwilling to lose it and aren't aware they're losing it? In which case, the last thing I want is for them to know who I am.
Absolutely. Perhaps we can tie this a bit to the book as well and talk about some of those insights. Red-Blooded Risk, what was the genesis of the book? Why did you actually write it?
Well, I've been thinking about risk all my life. And one of the things that occurs to me is, you know, most people talk about risk, they're talking about something bad. But risk is essential to finance, certainly, and then actually to a lot of other things. You know, if prices never changed, there'd be no reason to trade. And not just in financial markets, you know, prices weren't different in different places, there'd be no merchants. You know, if there's no uncertainty about business, then there'd be no reason to, you know, have investors other than, you know, just people who did riskless lending. And risk to finance is like energy to an engineer. You know, it's something you need to get anything done. But like energy, it can, you know, burn you, shock you, blow you up if you don't handle it correctly. So an awful lot of, you know, stuff people write about risk is kind of the equivalent of saying, well, if we never use any energy, then we never get in any trouble, right? If we never, you know, lit a fire to keep warm or to cook meat, then we'd never get, you know, burn our house down or get burned in the fire. If we never had electricity, then we wouldn't have people electrocuted. But that's really missing the point entirely. The, you know, the thing about risk or energy, you want to be able to control it and use it. So this is a book, Red-Blooded Risk, is sort of how I tell people, you know, you should think about it. Or, you know, a red-blooded risk taker doesn't seek out risk, is not a thrill seeker, is not somebody who's, you know, just looking to gamble because they're bored. But it's somebody who's not just willing to take risk, but, you know, kind of excited by, you know, wants to do it, takes risk energetically, enthusiastically, because there's something they can gain from it.
And when you say the secret history of Wall Street, what is that secret you're referring to?
Well, I got to tell you, I hate subtitles in general. And when I wrote The Poker Face of Wall Street, my first book, I successfully held that against the publisher for a subtitle. But this time I lost it. I said, no, you have to have a subtitle. And all the subtitles they suggested were much worse. And they said, you have to have something that, you know, tells people that this isn't a novel. And I said, you know, well, that's okay, so you can call it Red-Blooded Risk, not a novel, but they didn't go for that. So I thought about it. I said, well, okay, I think, you know, it's the history of Wall Street is really a history of risk taking. And it doesn't get reported that way very much. You know, Wall Street has always been very shy about letting outsiders know how much of the business is about risk, because, you know, what a lot of brokers and advisors and what people are doing is they're trying to imply that there isn't so much risk, that they know what's going to happen, or that they're investing your money prudently. They were always lobbying very strongly to say, no, invest, you know, stock market investing is not gambling. You know, it's something completely different. You know, and let's face it, there's, you know, risk is inherent to the whole activity. Risk is everything they're doing it about. If they knew what stocks were doing, they wouldn't be on television telling you, or they wouldn't be asking for a 1% management fee to, you know, buy the stocks that are going to go up. They'd just be buying the stocks that are going up. So I try to kind of give a history of Wall Street with emphasis on my time in it. So emphasis from the early 80s or so, to tell people what was really going on, very different from the official histories. And I think the most important point that a lot of people seem to have missed is that in the last 20 years or so, really going back, say, 30 years now, the last 30 years, Wall Street was completely re-engineered. It's entirely different than it used to be. Yet a lot of our regulation, a lot of our language, a lot of our journalism is really talking about it the way it was years ago. And the analogy I give in the book is I say, well, it's a lot like a digital camera. You know, you have a digital camera today. You use it for pretty much the same thing people used, you know, inexpensive cameras for, 40 years ago, 30 years ago. They take snapshots at parties, at vacations, you know, of themselves and friends, of sights they've seen and so on. It has a flash. It has a shutter button to take the picture and so on. But it's the inside, the way it works, is entirely different engineering. There's no, a physical similarity between an old film camera and what you have in your phone. And the same thing happened on Wall Street. You know, we kind of use it for the same thing. Investors put their money there to save for college or retirement, and companies go there to look for money. But the actual engineering behind it is completely different. And people don't have enough recognition of that, I think. And people come in with mindset, with terminology, and with regulation that was really meant for a completely different era.
When you say it's completely different, what specifically are you referring to?
Well, thing about completely is it's everything, right? But if I had to, you know, focus on one element, Wall Street up until the 70s was basically a sales business. I mean, all people on Wall Street wanted to do was take a fee, was to get people to trade and take a fee. And that was the entire business. And smart people didn't go into it, right? You typically would go to work at an investment bank. If you were from a good family, you went to a good school, and you weren't quite smart enough to be an accountant or brave enough to be a soldier or, clever enough to be a lawyer, you could always just go to Wall Street and sell bonds to your parents' friends. And when quant first showed up in Wall Street, so this is really in large numbers, we're talking late 70s, early 80s, we were welcomed initially because by the same way that Wall Street welcomed astrologers or people with crazy economic theories, anything, the job of people with these crazy theories, and they put us in with all the rest, is that you raise money from investors and you buy and sell securities with it, which pays fees to Wall Street. And the one thing Wall Street hated was, money that wasn't invested that way, money that was kept in mattresses or in savings banks or, people invested in their own businesses. So they welcomed anybody who came to Wall Street with a new pitch for getting investors' money. The quants were different from all the rest. All the rest had random returns. And random returns were exactly what Wall Street wanted, because it meant, somebody would be hot for a few years and a lot of money would pour in, which was good. And then they would get cold because they were just doing things randomly. And the money would flow out to somebody else and Wall Street would get a commission both ways. And everything would be good. But the quant actually made money consistently. And that changed the entire business. And it took Wall Street 15 years to really figure it out and adapt. But it moved from a model of people earning a fee, getting people to make random decisions, to a business of actually harnessing risk for the advantage of both the investors and the people who needed capital. And just fundamentally, it went from, I won't actually call it a fraud, but it's a difference between something that's essentially random, that's just generating a fee for people who are sitting in the middle without adding value either for companies or for individuals, to something that really worked. You can think of it as somebody built a machine that actually worked inside of something that had already been sold to people that was basically a fraud.
And you have a lot of experience with the quant side of Wall Street. Tell us a little bit about how that developed and you know, who maybe some of the pioneers were there, and whether you think that there's still an edge to be had on the quant side, given A, that there's a lot more competition, and B, we now have things like machine learning and big data, where everyone seems to be looking for that small edge.
Well, for pioneers, you have to go with Ed Thorpe, because not only did he invent blackjack card counting back in the late 50s, but in the 60s and 70s, he either invented or perfected, you know, an amazing number of the quant strategies people still use today. But there were lots of others, people who came to Wall Street. And one thing I emphasize is, when we talk about quants on Wall Street, we're not really talking about really sophisticated mathematics. There were people who were excellent mathematicians, of course, Jim Simons of Renaissance being, you know, one of the great mathematicians of the world, and then he hired some others, and there have been Duane Farmer was a spectacularly accomplished mathematician and physicist. Nassim Taleb is another one. So there are people who are really, really good mathematicians, but that's not what quant investing is mostly about. A lot of it is using very simple methods. It's mostly a question of being honest and rigorous, you know, putting things in numbers, looking at what works and what doesn't. A lot of very simple mathematics has made, you know, people very, very rich. In terms of it, you know, being, you know, the edge being gone, completely disagree. Actually, I was arguing with this with Ed Thorpe a few years back, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And he was saying, oh, well, so many people are doing it now, and, you know, I don't know if I'd make money. And I told him what our trading costs were, and his jaw dropped. And he said, well, boy, if I could trade at those costs, I could make all the money, I could make money. So, yeah, sure, Ed was doing it in 1960 with no competition, but he was paying 50 cents a share, you know, commission. And today the costs are so incredibly low that there's just so much more opportunity for quant. Also, quant methods do not force each other out. The more quants, the better, up to a point. There is a point of diminishing returns. It's kind of like people who say, well, if everybody invested in index funds and there'd be nobody around to set the price, okay, fine. But you could have 80, 90% of people in index funds. You could have 80 or 90% of investors in quant, and then it would not significantly reduce the edge from that. You'd have to go to 100% before you'd start really worrying about that. As far as machine learning and big data go, I've been working on that for 5, 6 years now, very serious. I mean, I've always been interested in it. When everybody started making these great successes, and by the way, making it more accessible, I don't know how many people know this. People, again, talk about big data and artificial intelligence and machine learning as if it's something, you know, you need to hire the latest PhD from Stanford to know. You know, if you know R, with very simple open source computer language, there are packages that do all the stuff. You know, you can just take any set of data, you can take, you can just run it through, you can do it yourself. You don't need a tremendous insight. And my experience in this stuff, when it works, it's not because somebody is the greatest machine learning scientist in history. I mean, I'm glad those people exist. But most of the success comes from people who really understand their data. And if you understand your data, you can put it through a generic algorithm and do very, very well. Unfortunately, it has not proved enormously successful at trading. I think it will someday. You know, listen, machines are smarter than people, and eventually it's going to come through when trading is not as complicated as driving a car. But so far, the results have been really disappointing. It's very useful for trading. If you know you want 100,000 shares of Microsoft, a machine learning algorithm can do better than the smartest algorithms, you know, designed consciously by people. But if you want something that's going to tell you to buy 100,000 shares of Microsoft, machine learning and big data are just not there yet. I don't know why. I don't know why this is proving to be an intractable problem compared to some others. But I've been looking at this stuff for a long time. And my experience is when you when big data and machine learning and artificial intelligence, they come on a new problem, it's almost always disappointing. It's almost always people say, this will be easy. They turn the algorithms that worked in the last application loose, and it's disappointing. And they learn something new. And they learn something new that improves machine learning. We haven't gotten to the point yet where you can take machine learning, go to any new application, whether it's finance or something else, and get immediate success. I think what tends to happen is people read about the successes, and it sounds that way. It sounds like, oh, you know, Google beat Go just by, you know, using this alpha, simple alpha algorithm and turning it loose on Go. Yeah, but thousands of artificial intelligence and machine learning researchers had tried Go before that, and none of it worked. But, you know, somehow Google hit on whatever magic it is that worked for Go. And someday somebody will do that for finance and trading, but it hasn't happened yet.
Do we actually know what Google did for Go, or is that another secret?
Well, I read a book, there's a book on it, and Google appears to be pretty open. But having read the book, I can't tell you I could, you know, turn around on my PC tomorrow and program it. So I suspect they left out a few key ingredients. You know, it's like when a world-class chef publishes a recipe and you say, oh, this is really easy. This is, I can make a signature dish. But when you make it in your kitchen, it's just not quite the same as it was in the restaurant. I don't know if it's that because they deliberately leave something out or if it's because there's just some skill that, you know, you have to be a world-class chef or a world-class programmer at Google to actually do that way. But at least in theory, they told us exactly how they did it.
Coming back to parallels between poker and financial markets or investing, how important to being successful at poker as well as investing, let's say, but let's start with poker, is not just understanding the probabilities and the numbers, but actually the psychology and the people who are at the table. And, you know, can you calibrate those two and what role each plays in the ultimate success?
Well, there's an old saying about poker that poker isn't a card game played with people. It's a people game played with cards. There is a minimum, what do I want to say? There's a basic mathematical understanding you need. And you don't necessarily have to understand it mathematically. Lots of people learned it through trial and error or learned it, you know, from just memorization. But, you know, you kind of have to understand the basic mathematics and approaches. And that varies by type of poker. Texas Hold'em, the type that's most popular today, is the least mathematically or mentally demanding form of poker ever invented. You know, some other forms of poker require good memory. But in Hold'em, if you see a card, it never gets turned over. So you don't have to remember anything. Something like Omaha, you know, can get kind of complicated in some of the combinations and can be, you know, sort of tricky to play sometimes. But more draw poker, you have to make a decision. Hold'em really has none of that. So it's the simplest form of poker in terms of the actual gameplay. But that doesn't really matter too much. If you got a complicated form of poker, you know, then a good card player. When I say a good card player, I mean somebody who is good at games like Gin Rummy or Bridge, you know, with traditional card player skills, will have a little bit of an advantage. A game like Hold'em, almost none. I mean, if you've, you know, read one book on Hold'em and played for a couple hours, then you really know everything about the game itself there is to know. But the psychology, you know, psychology never, it is always complicated. And that's really what poker is about. But not psychology in the sense of, you know, reading people's minds. The most important thing about poker is I tell people, if you want to make money at poker, you know, that's your goal, and that was my goal for playing, figure out what everybody else wants and give it to them in exchange for money. Most people who sit down at the poker table are there for other reasons. Some of them want to gamble. Some of them want to prove themselves. Some of them want a story to tell their girlfriend. Some of them want to, you know, win a big pot. And you can give that, all those things. You can give the people those things and win money. To me, you know, I come into trading, I really looked at it the exact same way. I said, okay, what do other people want? If I can give it to them in exchange for their money, that's how I'm going to succeed. If you give people what you want, what they want, then they keep doing it, and you can make a consistent living. If you trick people, if you give people things that they're really disappointed with, if you take their money and, you know, they feel bad about it, then yeah, you'll make some money in the short run, but it's hard to make a consistent living doing that.
It seems, you know, the market, the investing, you don't necessarily see the faces of who you're dealing with. I don't know if you're, you know, a large hedge fund, perhaps you know the counterparties more, or you get some intelligence on who's on the other side of a trade. But in general, it seems like there's a lot of anonymity. So how do you then think about this component of who are the people that I'm essentially competing with, and you know, how to give them what they want while getting their money? Are you basically looking at some way to kind of impute odds into the trades you're making?
Well, yeah. So that's sort of the two types of trader. Some traders do know their counterparties quite well, and they make a living knowing their counterparties, and that's who is paying their fees. You know, if they're making money, they're making it from their counterparties. As a quantitative trader, not only don't you see the faces of the people, you don't even see the trades, right? The computer's making the trades, so you're just designing the algorithm. And you don't think that your counterparty is probably not the person who's paying you. If you're doing convertible bond arbitrage, for example, okay, well, you're buying convertible bonds from the issuer. You're shorting the stock. You know, you're doing that through a broker and a dealer and some traders, and, you know, you're buying interest rate futures and so on. You're not, ultimately, you have to say to yourself, okay, it's not my counterparties. Downstream, somebody is losing money or making less money than they could because I have this locked in virtually guaranteed profit by convertible arbitrage. So you have to think, well, who is it? You know, is it issuers? Is it shareholders of the company? Is it, you know, some type of investor? Is there somebody for whom the trades I'm doing are actually making them better off in some way? It can't be making them money. I mean, net, I'm taking money out of the market, so somebody must be putting money into the market. But what are they getting for that? You know, are they fooled? Or if they're, you know, if they're not fooled, what are they getting in return? And in fact, that's exactly the, you know, we do those analyses very carefully, and we try to figure out who they are. Once you figure out who they are, the next step is say, okay, how can I serve them better? Right, they're my customers, and how can I make sure they know me? You know, give them a brand name so they come to me and, you know, give me their money instead of other people who may not be giving it to them as effectively. And most important, you watch them. And if for some reason they stop, maybe they shrink in size, maybe their business changes and they no longer want to give you money, you want to know that because you know that, okay, this is no longer going to work. If you don't do that, the only way you find out a strategy just stopped working is when you lose money, and that's expensive. You'd much rather see, oh, well, you know, the institutions that used to take the other side of this are no longer doing it, and therefore I should, you know, move out of the strategy.
What's your take on value-based or contrarian strategies where basically you're buying something that's beaten down, it's cheap on a valuation basis? Could you just say, well, the service I'm giving the other person is just letting them out of a terrible investment and letting them sleep again at night, or to not have them have to talk about this to their clients? I mean, how do you, yeah, do you ever consider valuation or contrarian strategy?
Sure. And one thing, though, there's a lot of confusion about this. The word value means different things to a quant and a non-quant. So to a non-quant like Warren Buffett, you know, value investing means a lot of fundamental research. It doesn't primarily mean cheap. Warren Buffett has said, you know, no, I'd rather get a great company at a fair price than a, you know, fair company at a great price. And what Warren Buffett calls value, quants call a combination of value and quality. So to a quant, value just means cheap. It means low price to book, a low price earnings. It just means cheap. But either sense of the word, yes, that the value investing, pure value investing, the service there is you are holding the unpopular side, the uncontrarian too. You're holding these stocks through a period of time where it's very unpleasant to hold them. And when things get better again and their values get back up to normal, you sell them back. So you're kind of warehousing for people the things they don't want to hold. Personally, as a quant investor, I don't like pure value. I like value. I love value. I think it's a very powerful factor, and I use it all the time in all my investing. But value by itself is a very long-term, lonely strategy. Value plus momentum is what I like. So I want to buy something cheap, but I want to wait till it starts going up. That saves me from two things. It saves me from holding something for 10 years before the market decides to recognize its value. It also saved me from being wrong. You know, sometimes the things that look like value turn out to be, you know, you turn out to be wrong about it. I go to zero. In return, I don't get as much as a value. You know, value investor might buy it at the bottom. You know, I might buy it 10, 20% above the bottom, but that's okay. I would much rather trade that way and wait for it. Some people prefer what they call value with a catalyst or value with a trigger. And that means value, but you can see some events in the short term that are going to make it start going up. That's a little better, but I prefer value plus momentum. I want stuff that's cheap and going up. And I want a short stuff that's expensive and going down. And that combination works pretty well.
So one screen I've seen along those lines, and I'm curious whether it's at all similar to what you use, is basically price to sales of less than one and relative strength, basically, where it's faring well on that metric. So that would be the combination of value and momentum. Is that similar to what you would use?
Yes. I mean, it is one of the measures. Now, personally, what I prefer to do is not put great faith in any one measure. I much prefer to have 100 measures, you know, 100 measures of value, 100 measures of momentum. And I like it when, you know, of the, say, 200 measures, I would like, you know, if 140 are pointing in the same direction, that makes me very happy. I don't really care if, you know, 20 of them are screaming, you know, the biggest signal they've ever seen. I like to see all the, you know, a majority, more than a majority, you know, two thirds of the things all lighting up the same way. So the trouble with just using, say, your price to sales and your relative strength is, well, that's going to work for some companies, but it's not going to work. You know, there's going to be some companies for which that just completely misses the boat. You know, maybe last year's sales were wildly inflated for some reason. Maybe their margins are negative. They're losing money on those sales, you know, and so on. So if you do price to sales, but you also do price to book, you do price to earnings, you do, you know, other things. And, you know, for momentum, you look at relative strength, you look at earnings momentum, you look at fundamental momentum, you know, our sales going up, our earnings going up, is profitability going up. And by combining a whole lot of these things, you look for, you're never going to find something where, you know, 200 measures all show it's going up. But again, I trust, you know, I believe kind of in wisdom of crowds. I trust that the majority are all pointing in the same direction, a solid majority all pointing in the same direction. That is the kind of signal I like to see.
And just to get back a little bit to one of the major topics of the book or your career, actually, is your notion of risk management. Tell us a little bit more about that, how you approach it, and how it's different from, let's say, the Wall Street definition of risk management.
The sort of standard model in economics is that risk is bad and that investors want to maximize expected return subject to a risk constraint, or alternatively minimize risk subject to expected value constraint. To me, that's not risk. To me, that's a portfolio management decision. To me, risk is not having a good risk return ratio, but it's surviving long enough so your risk return ratio has any relevance. It's up to the portfolio manager or the trader or the line risk taker, however you want to call it. That person is supposed to be making good bets. And if that person isn't making good bets, you know, no risk management can save it. If you don't trust somebody to make a decision, you don't hire a second person to look over their shoulder, you fire them and hire somebody you do trust to make good decisions. But even making good individual decisions all the time, even a trader who only makes good bets can still run into disaster. Due to a string of losses, due to overbetting, or a very common thing is underbetting, you know, not betting enough so that you make enough money when you're right to pay the losses when you're wrong. So the risk manager is orthogonal. You know, the portfolio manager is looking around to find the best bets they can make or the best collection of securities to put in a portfolio, best trades. The risk manager is coming and say, okay, here's how we're going to size them. Here's how we're going to, here's our strategy for growth. Here's how we're going to increase bets when things go well. Here's how we're going to cut losses when they go bad. And it's a quantitative field. The most important insight about risk management is portfolio management, trading, or any form of line risk taking is hard. You know, we know that even the best traders, you know, are happy to be right, you know, 55% of the time, whatever, 51% if you're a quant, maybe 60% if you're a real genius qualitative trader or something. You know, every portfolio manager buys stocks that go down. It just, you know, nobody would try to have every single stock go up. So it's hard, and you're only right a small fraction of you know, over 50%, but enough to make a consistent profit in the long run. Risk management is easy. Risk management is fundamentally a mathematical process. It is pretty easy to tell if the risk management is good or bad. It's pretty easy to tell if your trades are sized properly, if you're getting out, you know, at the right time, or you're getting out too soon or too late, if you're letting your profits run too long or too short, cutting your losses too soon or too late. These things can be pretty easily measured after the fact. So, you know, portfolio managers, we give them a lot of latitude. You know, if guys had a, you know, good track record for 4 or 5 years, they run through a losing streak, we say, oh, well, you know, that just happens. You know, you're going to have, even the best managers are going to have bad years and bad quarters. You should not give your risk manager that kind of latitude. You know, if your risk manager does not do a clear, good job, you know, pretty much every month, then there's something wrong. And I think people often tend to, you know, apply the loose standards we apply for portfolio managers and traders and apply them to risk managers and let them off the hook too easily.
That's interesting. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Either an example or just sort of how it can go bad if you kind of let a risk manager be a little loose with the art of risk management?
Well, okay, let's say, you know, it's a quarter and you're reviewing all your trades for the quarter, and, you know, and you find out, you go to the portfolio, the trader, say, and you say, well, gee, you know, only 48% of your trades worked this quarter, and you lost money. You say, okay, well, it's, you know, I expect long run to make, say, 53% of them winning, and, you know, if you get just random luck of a draw, 48% work. I mean, you still work with him to figure out, well, was there a consistent pattern? Was there something you're doing wrong? Was there something that changed? Is there something in the market you missed? You look for it, but you don't, you know, you don't automatically assume that's bad any more than, you know, if a baseball player goes up to the plate and strikes out, you don't, you know, they're yelling at him and saying, you know, he's screwed up. You just, you know, they're going to strike out sometime. But now you go to the risk manager and say, okay, well, let's look. Was our trade sizing appropriate? You know, would we have more money today if we had made every trade the same size? And if that's true, and by the way, it very often is, even for experienced risk takers, you say, okay, well, then all your trade, you know, your trade sizing actually took money away from us. We bet more money when we were wrong than when we were right. Okay, that's not a hard thing to get right. That's not something that you should say, well, gee, just guess you had a bad quarter, try and do better next quarter. That's something that's saying, okay, you know, you're just not doing your job. If the trades were grossly missized, if your metrics are just out of whack, where you're just losing way too much money on your losing trades, or you're making too little on your winning trades. These are things that, you know, the risk manager really has to answer for. And the answer can't just be, oh, well, you know, luck of the draw.
Well, that's a great point. And it brings me to another question which I think connects kind of position sizing to the confidence in a position or the assessment of probabilities, and that's the Kelly formula. What's your take on the use of Kelly in investing, and then would it actually fall into the portfolio managers or the risk managers bucket?
Yeah, it's clearly in the risk managers bucket, right? So it's Kelly is all about bet sizing, and a big fan. And the basic principle of Kelly is that you work to maximize your median outcome. So you don't go out there to maximize your expected value. And the reason is, you know, you're going to take millions of risks in your life, and over millions of risks, you're going to get something pretty close to your median outcome. You know, if you flip a coin a million times, you get pretty close to 50% heads. And therefore, it makes sense to make sure that's the best place it possibly can be. Now, there are a lot of sort of practical, pitfalls in applying Kelly to real investment decisions. Kelly is very sensitive to the left tail of the distribution. So, you know, even some very low probability big risks can cause you to substantially reduce your position size. Kelly is also very sensitive to uncertainty about the edge. So if you're not sure about what size edge you have, that can have a big impact on your decision. So if you just take the formula out of a textbook and you just apply it to some numbers without thinking too hard about them, you will get an answer that's probably oversizing. You're probably going to overbet doing it that way. But if you're sensitive to the uncertainty and you're sensitive to the left tail risk, Kelly works. And the big thing Kelly gives you is not the mathematical formula. The big thing Kelly gives you is it says every trade can be evaluated on its own. You don't have to ask somebody, what's your utility to risk? What's your attitude toward risk? You don't have to ask them, how many trades do you do yesterday? How did they do? What trades do you have tomorrow? You don't have to ask them about their utility, psychological utility or financial utility, economic utility, whatever. It's just numbers, and each trade is done in isolation. It may not be perfect, but simplifying the decision is very important because, you know, a simplified decision, you're not going to be too far wrong. The big thing about risk management is not getting everything sized exactly correctly each time, or, you know, cutting each loss at exactly the right time, or letting each profit run exactly the right amount. The trick to risk management is avoiding the really disastrous decisions. And if you can be, you know, within 20% of what you should be on all your trades, you're going to be fine. You might even do better than somebody who's exactly right each time, and you're not going to do much worse. But if you're exactly right 80% of the time, but have big errors the other 20%, then you're going to be toast.
And is that what you're referring to with the left tail of Kelly, where basically you need to avoid or adjust for those outlier risks, and then you cannot bet what Kelly would normally suggest?
Yeah, they're similar outcome, but different reasons. Okay, so yeah, so you have to survive two things. What Kelly is going to help you do is make sure that you're not wildly overbetting or underbetting to the point where you can't succeed. And it's very easy to do, by the way. You can look like a very successful trader, but you can be pursuing a strategy that is guaranteed to blow up in the long run. The left tail risk is actually kind of it's another issue, but it's the same thing. Yeah, you got to avoid, you know, in your career, if you're, you know, have a professional career on Wall Street over the years, you're going to have some one in a million events happen to you. You know, if you do a million trades, well, you know, one of them is going to have the worst outcome, one in a million probability. So you have to think about that. Now you don't expect that to be a good outcome. You can't, you know, run your trading such that even in the one in a million case, you still make money, but it's got to be survivable. It can't actually kill you. It can't end your career. So you got to think, okay, even in a one in a million case, which is most people don't think anywhere near that much of that. Most people can't, you know, think more than like 10% probability of the tails. But you got to think, that is going to happen to me at some point in my career. So I got to make sure if this is the trade it happens on, well, you know, maybe I'll lose my job. Maybe I'll, you know, lose $1 million or whatever. But whatever I'm going to lose, it won't end my career. Because if you end your career, you not only lose that bet, you lose everything you were going to make on all your future bets.
Anything times zero is zero.
Yeah. You got one zero. It doesn't matter what your other successes are. If you got one zero, you multiply it all together, you come out at zero. So you got to do it. And you know, in some cases for some, you know, let's say you're running a hedge fund and there are lots of hedge funds. If they have a down 10% year, that's going to be it for the fund. It's going to close forever. And it doesn't matter what it did in the past or whatever. And if that's true for your fund, you know, you got to know that. You got to size your bets so that whatever happens, you don't lose 10%.
Absolutely. Well, Aaron, this has been terrific, very interesting and educational. Perhaps before we finish up, one question I'd just like to ask of authors or people who have successfully written at least one book and you've published several is how do you actually do that? What's your writing process look like that you are able to be so productive?
Okay, well, I don't necessarily hold this out as a model for everyone, but I always wanted to write a book. I had this idea, you know, you hear somebody, you know, become author of, that just struck me as a really proud title. I never wanted to be king. I never wanted to be Nobel Prize winner, but I did want to be author of. But I was busy. I had lots of other things to do. And I was playing poker one day with the business editor for Wiley. And he said, well, Aaron, this is back in the middle of the poker boom. I said, well, Aaron, if you give me a poker book I can put on the business shelf, I'll publish it. So I said, okay, here's my opportunity to, you know, become author of. So I immediately, you know, signed up. We agreed on the title, The Poker Face of Wall Street. And then I went and said, okay, what is that? You know, and I started writing and it turned out to be remarkably easy for me. And I realized the reason was. I'd been thinking about this book, you know, in the shower, on my commute, you know, walking in the woods, whatever. I'd been thinking about this book for 5 years, and I really had it all worked out. I just had to sit down, and it just kind of came out. I will say that getting the draft into the publisher was half the work. The other half comes afterwards, and the other half is not as pleasant. I enjoyed writing it. I was working full-time at a demanding job while I was writing it, but I just put aside like half an hour, an hour, during a downtime in work, maybe, you know, weekend and whatever. And it just came through pretty easily. The editing, the business stuff, promoting the book, all that kind of stuff, that I didn't take so naturally to. And then that was an awful lot of work. But I was lucky in three respects. First, that, playing poker with a business editor who wanted a book, you know, that just, you know, doesn't happen to everybody, but if it does, you got to grab it. Everybody gets opportunity. You know, that doesn't happen to everybody, but everybody's got, you know, things fall in their lap during their life at one point or another. You got to grab it and run with it. A second one was that it happened at a time when I actually had a book in my head and didn't know it. And the third one was it hit on a lot of initial success. Luck came out at the right time, who knows, but, you know, got a lot of reviews at Business Week, picked it to one of the top 10 books. I was working for an employer who was willing to let me publish a book, you know, all the things kind of came together. Nassim Taleb is a good friend of mine, and he said, well, here's the strategy for a book. You know, you get your first book published, you get it up to 10,000 copies. Once it gets up to 10,000 copies, they put it in paperback. Once they put it in paperback, it automatically goes to 50,000. Once it goes into 50,000, you can write books for the rest of your life. You know, even if all your other books are flops, the fact that you once sold 50,000 means publishers will sign you up. And that's, he actually wrote Dynamic Hedging, which did not sell 10,000 copies, but then he wrote Fooled by Randomness, which did, and then he got a $1 million advance for The Black Swan, and you know, now he became a big celebrity. But that was kind of, I was trying to duplicate him, and I did with my first book. Since subsequent, I haven't had anywhere near his publishing success, but we talked about it a lot, and I said, I'm not writing a book to sell a million copies. You know, it would be nice to sell a million, but I don't expect to do it. I want a book that's selling 500 copies a month 5 years after it's published. And that I accomplished, and that was really a big thing. You know, it's always heartening to look and say, hey, people are still buying this book. People are still reading these books. It continues to be relevant. It continues to be, people who read it must be, you know, telling other people to read it. And a lot more people are going to read 50 Shades of Grey than ever read any one of my books. But I tell myself, I don't know, that I'm getting to the right people. I'm getting the people I wanted to talk to. And one really nice thing about writing a book is you get a lot of positive mail. I don't know why, but, you know, if you put up a blog post, you write a column for Bloomberg or something like that, you mostly hear from people who hate you. But you write a book, you mostly hear from people who love it. And the biggest comment I got for Poker Face totally surprised me. I must have gotten over 100 emails that were basically like some of our phone calls or whatever, people saying, you know, I played poker and I was feeling really bad about it. And my girlfriend and my mother-in-law, you know, all these people, they just told me I was wasting my life. And I felt like, you know, barely above a criminal and this and that. And I read your book and I feel really good about myself. And I'm going to, you know, go out and use, you know, you showed me that I actually have a lot of good stuff. I'm going to go out and use it. I didn't write the book to do that. I didn't plan them that way. I'm not even sure I agree. They probably were wasting their lives, a lot of them. But yeah, that felt really good. And that's the kind of satisfaction you're being out there. I highly recommend anybody who's ever thought about being an author, I tell you, you know, do it before books, you know, a lot of, or, you know, before there are no more books, get out there and become an author of.
Become an author, and if you're willing to buy 10,000 hard copies of your own book, you might actually be able to write books for the rest of your life.
Believe me, that strategy, actually, it's not so much that. It's the other line, I didn't tell you this, but the other part of it is if you sell fewer than 3,000, then you can't write another book, or you have to, you know, just lie and say you've never written a book before. So there are people who buy to get up to the 3,000 because they want to get another book contract.
So there is a risk.
By the way, these are old numbers, by the way. These were things from maybe 2005 or so when I was going over the numbers and talking about it with Nassim. So I don't know if the market, I think things have changed. I think with, you know, the online marketing and so on, things that you don't need to have so many copies to be successful. On the other hand, it's much harder to get that million seller.
Well, terrific. Aaron, this has been really great. Truly appreciate your perspective and your insights.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I hope people enjoy it and listen to it.
Absolutely. Thank you, and goodbye for now.
Goodbye.